Hello, Coffee House Shops listeners. My name is Freddie Gray, and I edit The Spectator's US edition. I know you're all huge Westminster enthusiasts, but Brexit is over, and the big story of 2020 is going to be the American election. So I would like to urge you all to listen to my Americano podcast, where we discuss everything that's going on in Trump world and Democrat world. If you go to spectator.co.uk/Americano, you can listen to it all.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. Now, normally on Wednesdays we give you a rundown of briefly what happened in Prime Minister's questions, but today that was slightly overshadowed by the former Chancellor Sajid Javid's statement to the House afterwards. Here's what he had to say.
It has always been the case that advisers advise, ministers decide, and ministers decide on their advisers. I can't see why the Treasury, with the vital role that it plays, should be the exception to that. A Chancellor, like all Cabinet Ministers, has to be able to give candid advice to a Prime Minister so he is speaking truth to power. I believe that the arrangement proposed would significantly inhibit that, and it would not have been in the national interest.
James, what do you make of it?
I thought it was a carefully couched statement from Sajid Javid. It avoided picking a fight with the Prime Minister personally, but made clear that his beef was with the kind of way that this number 10 operated, what he called the comings and goings. And he was basically saying, that's why I couldn't accept the idea that my minister should go. Brackets. Interestingly, technically all special advisors in government work for the Prime Minister. Close brackets. So that I thought was interesting politically where he was trying to position himself. He was trying to set himself up as a low-tax conservative, emphasising that the tax burden is already at the highest rate it's been in decades, and basically saying that he would be against any further tax rises. He also defended his fiscal rules, which everyone, you know, the view is are under threat at the moment. But I thought it was particularly striking that the point he chose to emphasise about the fiscal rules was the idea that debt should be lower as a percentage of GDP at the end of the parliament than it is now. That is clearly what he regards as the most important of the fiscal rules that he has left behind.
Now, Fraser, we can talk about the fiscal rules in just a second, but first of all, I mean, Sajid Javid's speech wasn't expected to be a particularly spicy one. He said he was going to be very gracious, but I suspect that it was probably a bit more hard-hitting than some people were expecting. So do you think he'll be trouble on the backbenches for Boris Johnson in the days to come?
I think he's positioning himself as a kind of one-man fiscal watchdog. He fought very hard during the election campaign for the government to say, we're going to stay within these fiscal boundaries. And he won that battle after the intervention of Isaac Levidou, the Tory campaign manager. And now, of course, he reckons he's lost his job over this, amongst other things. Now, he tends to be of a sort of low-tax Tory, Sajid Javid, by instinct, although he really did bend over backwards to accommodate Boris Johnson's various demands. So I think we can expect him to be pointing out that, look, manifesto pledge was to get the debt-to-GDP ratio down. We have not done this. This isn't good enough. We need to hold ourselves to a higher standard. Now, technically speaking, that ought to be done by the Office for Budget Responsibility. Now, the OBR is losing Robert Choate, its director. The OBR was set up by George Osborne to perform exactly his function, to stop the Treasury spending what it wants, to be that independent voice saying, hang on, government, you are spending way more and you're trying to cover it up by making optimistic assumptions. So I think this is what Sajid Javid is doing. Also, he's making a sort of point about the independence or the quasi-independence of the Treasury. This will seem to foreigners rather strange, right? Why should the finance department consider itself a kind of opposition to the government? Why should the Treasury be a check and a balance? Why should it be up to the Treasury to basically stop number 10 doing what it wants to do? That always has tended to be a feature of the British government. That was pretty bad in the Blair years, where Gordon Brown really did use its power to drive a coach and horses through Tony Blair's attempts at moderation and decentralisation. But then again, in the 70s, it was very helpful, where patriots in the Treasury fed false forecasts to to Dennis Healey and got him to call in the IMF to do a bailout and spending reform. Now, afterwards, Dennis Healey found out that the Treasury basically hoodwinked him, and he was saying if they hadn't done that, maybe we wouldn't need to have called in the IMF, but it was certainly necessary. Now, you can argue, by the way, I was in favour of them doing that, but you reading that, you do think, my God, the Treasury really does get up to some quite dramatic tricks. And it does. Boris Johnson wants to call an end to those tricks, call an end to its independence. So constitutionally, this certainly is a moment. And Sajid Javid is calling this out rightly as a moment. But there'll be a great many people who would have read James's column in The Sun a couple of weeks ago, thinking that if you do get a government with number 10, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury, a very powerful machine, if it's used well, that's a big if.
And James, Sajid Javid's warning comes as the Institute for Fiscal Studies says today that unless the government hikes taxes in the upcoming budget, it will be risking breaking its own rules on borrowing. So what do you think it's going to choose, breaking the rules or hiking taxes?
So I think it's worth looking at the fiscal rules and which bits of it are sensible and which bits of it aren't. I mean, the one thing that is clearly not sensible is the desire for an exact balance. Because the number of accounting changes or revisions that you have, you could get into a situation where suddenly at the last minute you're having to scramble around to find an extra £10 billion because of an accounting change. I mean, I think it would be sensible for the government to give itself some leeway, say 1% either way, on that question. That I think is the first criticism. Then I think the second thing is a more nuanced argument, which is this, which is, you know, some people argue that as Sajid Javid did in an interview with Fraser during the election campaign, that we are into an era of permanently low interest rates. Mm. If you are into a period of permanently low interest rates, as Sajid Javid said in that interview, then by logic you should be more relaxed about government debt, because the cost of servicing that debt is going to stay low for a very long time. And so therefore, this is your moment to fund your projects. And I think another thing which is worth considering is, you know, we currently have rules on the division between capital and current spending, which means that if you want to build a bridge, for example, that counts as capital. But if you want to improve the skills of your workforce, something that will, I think, improve productivity as much as a bridge, that counts as current spending, and so you can't spend it on capital. I think looking at those rules would be a sensible step. And, you know, I think it was something that, you know, when Sajid Javid was chancellor, he felt should be done at some point. And so I think he is right to alight on the point of, you know, where is the debt level at the end of the parliament is a bigger question. I think the exact balance and these definitions of capital and current spending are two things the government should be prepared to move on.
I think this government's going to start spending like a bunch of drunken Keynesians now. The old rules used to be that when governments spend too much, if they don't have a credible plan to pay back their debt, they'll get punished by the markets because the markets will charge more interest on the money that governments always borrow in the form of gilt yields. Those gilt yields have collapsed. If you look at the figure now, it's 0.54%. That's the interest that they're charged on a 10-year borrowing. Now, we release these figures every day in our Evening Blend email. We've done it for the last 4 years, right at the bottom. You can just see how cheap it is for government to borrow. And the reason we keep it at the bottom of the email is a reminder that this is the realpolitik for the government, that yes, they are midway through tearing up their spending plan, but are they being punished by the markets? Exactly the opposite. They can borrow at a far cheaper rate than they were able to do a year ago, 2 years ago. And so you're seeing this disconnect now, really, between the fiscal behaviour of government and the reaction of markets. For a long, long time, the reason that you had to balance the budget to get back in the black was because of the way financial markets worked. But what did we see yesterday? Stock markets plunge around the world, a rush of money out of the markets and into gilts, into treasuries, and the cost of government borrowing going down even further. So right now, if you're government, you look at this and you think, you know what, I really don't need to worry too much about spending and borrowing because the markets are looking for an excuse to lend money to governments. So spend, I am going to do.
Is there a risk that these historically low interest rates will bounce back to where they were before?
I don't know. Well, it's a risk, but people have been getting that risk wrong for ages. I mean, for about 15 years, people have thought, oh, these low rates are a freak. In a couple of years' time, they're going to bounce back to normal. It simply hasn't happened. And while this doesn't happen, then governments lose the act of discipline. They start to think, well, we're not scared of the bond markets anymore. Therefore, we are going to borrow with a barely credible plan to how we're going to control our debt levels. troubles down the line. Now, this comes at a time where Boris instinctively wants to borrow. He told James in the interview that he thinks austerity was a mistake. And by the way, he's not the only one thinking that. You can look at a lot of central bankers now who say, but looking back over the evidence of the last 10 years, were governments wrong to think that unless they managed to get the deficit down, the markets were going to punish them with higher gilt yields? Or is it the case that there's now so much money, the Asian savings glut and other global factors, looking for a home, that governments could get away with a lot more misbehaviour than they did in the last 10 years? And I think that's what's happening, and I think we're in for another bout of misbehaviour.
And James, speaking of government misbehaviour, Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions attacked Boris Johnson on the fact that he's rarely been seen, or he hasn't really visited any of the flooding sites around the country in the last couple of weeks, calling him a part-time PM. Do you think that attack holds water, in a terrible pun?
I think it would be more potent if Boris Johnson was still trying to write his Daily Telegraph column or write his books and all that stuff. I think there is an interesting question here, because both sides believe they're onto something. So the number 10 view is, you know, the value of a prime minister appearance has been reduced too far. There have been too many of them in recent years, too many PR opportunities. They're going to hold him back, use him less. And they think that most voters think that, you know, sending a VIP to floods distracts, right? I think the challenge for him is they haven't worked out another way to send out the message that he cares, essentially. I mean that is a problem. I also think there's an interesting point that Katie makes in the coming issue of the magazine, which is that, you know, if Keir Starmer wins the Labour leadership, which looks fairly pretty certain at the moment, his plan is to try and take advantage of his government boycott of various programmes to kind of flood the airways with Labour people, try and make the government pay a price for it that way. Again, I think the government's view is that, you know, they're not particularly fussed about who, in inverted commas, wins the Today programme every morning. So I think you do see a tension here.
Mm. Wasn't Boris stung as well recently, when he went off to visit some disasters?
On his campaign trail, yeah. And he had to hide in a giant fridge.
He's basically told to go home by some of them, but what are you doing here?
But you always get that. I mean, the kind of question is, right, which is, yes, you're always going to get a bit of flack when you turn up in these places. But I think turning up in these places does do two things. It, one, does show that you are, that you care, which is an important thing. And the second is, it sends a message to the bureaucracy about the desire to kind of get things done and push things through the system. This is a priority for the government. I think the other danger as Prime Minister is, you know, at what point do you break with this, I'm not turning up? If Shrewsbury ends up underwater, does that mean that the Prime Minister breaks away from this policy of not visiting and goes? I mean, this is the danger. I think previous number 10s have attempted things like this and decided that just going quickly and getting out of the way is the easiest way to handle the situation.
Fraser, number 10 over the last couple of weeks has said that this is a bubble issue and that voters out in the country don't really care if they see him or not. They more care about what the emergency services are doing, whether any of that is effective. Do you think that's true? It is a bubble issue, or is it now cutting through?
No, I think it's a bubble issue. Us journalists always like events to report on, and we're going to get a lot fewer of these. I reckon that the funny thing about Boris Johnson was, when he became Prime Minister, people thought, look at him, he's a clown, he's a showman, he's going to be on every zip wire in the country, he's just going to be on his sort of tour. And it turns out not to have done that, really. He hasn't been somebody who's tried to grab headlines. I, however, would have liked to have seen him out making speeches and more serious interventions out in the country more than he's done. Like, I know that the few days after he became Prime Minister, he went straight back up to the north of England to go and give a speech. And I thought that was quite a nice touch. Basically, you dance with the one who brung you, as Shania Twain once said. And
Ronald Reagan said that.
Well, he was quoting a song which Shania more memorably encapsulated.
I thought her pop career was after the Reagan presidency.
No, well, it was, but Reagan was quoting an old song from his youth, which Shania covered.
Honestly, James.
I mean,
I should have known better than to argue with the editor about popular music.
Well, the thing is, he was dancing with the ones who brought him. He did go back to the North. And I'd like to see him do this a lot more. I mean, not for photo shoots, not for posing with sandbags on floodplains, but I would like to see him at least every fortnight go up to these places that have never voted Tory before and just do something to recognise that he is working for them. It's all very well to say the day after, thank you, I'm so humbled, I'm not going to forget you. Politicians are very good at saying that the day after, not so good at doing that a month and 2 months on. So I'm all for his no photo shoot policy, but I would like him to go out there a bit more into the country.
James and Fraser, thanks very much. And thanks to all of you who came to the Amnesty debate last night. And for those of you who couldn't come, the audio of it will be available on Spectator Radio later today. That's on Wednesday. So just check it out there. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow. You gotta dance with the one that brought you in.